You're listening to Radio Albion, talk radio for the nationalist community.
Welcome to the Daily Nationalist. Today's date is Wednesday the 18th of March 2020 and you're listening to me, Sven Longshanks, broadcasting at radioalbion.com. Well, I hope you've enjoyed listening to the greatest Britons over the last few days. I've been away on location at the Patriotic Alternative Conference, in case you hadn't already guessed. We put the speeches up yesterday. I'm very pleased with the audio quality of them. We had a fantastic time. Around about 200 of us there that defied the corona scare, which I will be talking about a little bit later on in this podcast. But the conference itself was easily the best conference I've ever been to. I'm not just saying that because I was involved in the organization of it. It was easily the most professional, the best venue. You could tell that so much thought had gone into it. You know, it wasn't just sort of taking place in some old school hall somewhere or a council hall or anything like that. It was a decent venue, a very, very good venue. And of course, at the end, we had a collection for the venue staff, as we did last time, and as I hope we continue to do, to show our appreciation for the way that they looked after us. It was very good to meet Jason Coney, no white guilt, who is exactly the same offline as he is online. And of course, that's something that really does matter to me, that people are the same when you meet them, that they are in their podcasts. It's so important that people are genuine and that they have integrity. And I was very impressed with his integrity. And I've always thought I'd like to see what he was like with a real live audience there, because he's always so inspirational when you hear him on Patriotic Weekly Review with Mark. Obviously, I'd met Laura before. I'd met Millennial Woes before. Simon Harris was unable to be there, unfortunately. But thanks to technical wizardry, we were able to hear his speech. And I do apologise for the low quality of the recording of Mark's introduction. That's because we were unable to record both Mark's introduction and Simon's speech through the computer, because we had to pull audio plugs out and swap them around for a projector plug, and it meant that the audio plug could no longer go into the computer. It was quite a technical feat, actually, to reverse the direction of the audio and get that set up. So I was really pleased that went okay. It was lovely to meet Dion again, who I met at the last conference, and hopefully we'll have Simon, Dion, and Jason on the Daily Nationalist next week, and we can get to know them a little bit better on there. We were concerned that people were not going to turn up because of the coronavirus scare. And there were a few people that kindly let us know and said that they were going to be unable to be there. But we were able to donate their tickets to others that wished to go, so we still had a full venue. And I think if it had been another week, then maybe we would have had to cancel. And if we'd had it a week earlier, maybe people wouldn't have been so careful about biohygiene. I have to give out a huge thank you to, I won't actually give his name, so I'm not sure whether he would want his name being given out. But there was a very, very kind soul that actually brought litres of hand sanitizer with him, and masks, should anybody have wished to wear masks. And in a time when you can't find hand sanitizer for love nor money in the shops, that was a really, really good thing to do. And you can actually make up your own hand sanitizer. There's a substance called BAC 50, which you can still find it on places online, and you can mix up your own hand sanitizer from that. So any of you out there that are having problems getting hold of hand sanitizer, look up this substance called BAC 50, benzalkonium chloride, I believe it is. I came back feeling very healthy. I think I did listen out for coughs while I was there, and there were one or two coughs that I picked out in the audience. Not much. I think anybody that actually had a cold or flu-like symptoms wouldn't have actually gone. We had a very big, broad range, age range there as well. I would say we probably had people aged from 18-90 right the way up to people in their 90s, which was fantastic to see. We do like to see our elderly able to come along to these meetings and know that they're going to be safe and they're not going to be violently attacked by savage leftists. So all in all, it was a great conference, and I hope you liked the audio from it. But I really did want to talk today about Corona, and I've held off from this, and there's so much that we could talk about the way that this affects nationalism. I mean, the general public have got to be absolutely furious at the way that this has been handled. And it's all to do with the globalist, liberal, progressive mindset that our politicians have. I mean, they're even saying now, well, we couldn't possibly do what China did because that would go against people's human rights. Well, their human rights to travel about and infect people with their disease. You mean, we've seen what happened in Italy, where they refused to enforce quarantines on people, and people that, should we just say, weren't native to Italy, a particular person that was not native to Italy, decided to ignore the quarantine, and he decided to go and carry on working at his food delivery restaurant and carry on being involved in the preparation of food. And of course, he became a super spreader. This is where our liberal values end up. I mean, we've been pointing out for years about the increase in crime, the increase in rape, the increase in terrorism, the increase in drug use and drug dealing. We've pointed out the increase in diseases that we haven't heard of for 100 years in the West that are suddenly popping up again, the increase in sexually transmitted diseases. And now we've got the threat of this coronavirus, which is only here because of globalism. It's only here because we refused to close the borders when we first heard about this. I mean, we were looking at what was happening in China. We were looking at them building this pop-up hospital, which was amazing to build two, or maybe it was three that they did. They just said, we're going to build a hospital within a week. 10 days later, it was there. It was done. And everybody was saying, isn't that amazing? Look at that in the speeded up motion. Look at the diggers. And it was as if we were in a daze. We were just watching that and saying, look how interesting that is. So why weren't any of our countries doing that? Why weren't we building extra pop-up hospitals in anticipation of the virus hitting here? Because it seems to me that we had two choices back then. Number one, close the borders to China instantly. Isolate China, quarantine China, make certain that nobody comes out of China. That's option number one. They didn't do that. They decided, we will keep flying people in and out of China. We will even bring back people that we know that have the disease from China into our countries, and people that are quarantined. So we didn't close the borders, but we didn't build any pop-up hospitals either. The least our governments could have done, if they had refused to isolate the threat, is to mitigate the threat by building the hospitals back then, 3 months ago, 4 months ago. I think it was at the beginning of December when we learned about this. We had 4 months to build new hospitals. And look what's happened now. Italy is on the verge of collapse. They don't have enough intensive care units. And people are saying, oh, well, this is just like the flu, or it's just like a bad dose of the flu. It's nothing like the flu. The people that are susceptible to it, first, it causes necrosis of the lungs. You get lesions on your lungs. And in actual fact, that's one of the best ways they can test for it. They can just x-ray somebody. And if they've got all these black blodges on their lungs, which is dead tissue, then you know that they've got COVID-19. So they get these lesions on their lungs. They get this necrosis. The skin falls off and it collects at the bottom of the lungs. And that's what causes the pneumonia type symptoms. Pneumonia is when your lungs flood with fluid. So, of course, if you've got dead skin, dead cells that are collecting in the bottom of your lungs, you're going to get this fluid. So that's when you get the pneumonia type symptoms. But then it also gets into your central nervous system, into the parts that is responsible for telling your lungs that they need to be breathing in and out. It's obviously to do with muscles, but it's autonomic muscles. We don't actually think about breathing. It just happens naturally. So the virus then gets into that part of you, and it stops you a bit from being able to inflate and deflate your lungs, which is when you have to be put on a ventilator. And we hear Boris Johnson talking about ventilators now. We need more ventilators. We need more ventilators. Obviously, you need people to operate these ventilators, because when somebody is put on a ventilator, they have to be put into a comatose state. It's not like you can be conscious while that is happening. So they then have to put you on a ventilator. And once you're on the ventilator, then your kidneys go and you have to be put on a dialysis machine. Does this sound like the flu to you? If you're lucky enough to come round after that, you had better not been on that ventilator for any length of time, because if you have been on that ventilator for any length of time, then there's going to be brain damage. And then when you do come off it, there's no guarantee that you aren't going to be susceptible to being infected again. So the best course of action with this is to avoid becoming infected in the first place. People might say, well, it's only old people that are susceptible. Well, we've got people that are in their 30s, in their 40s, that have died of this. We don't know whether maybe it's just taking longer for young people to actually come out with all these symptoms. And all of this could have been avoided if they had just quarantined China. So why didn't they quarantine China? They didn't quarantine China because they thought that would harm business too much. Look at how business is being harmed now that they did nothing about it and just thought, well, let's just hope it goes away. Let's just hope it isn't so bad as the Chinese made it out. The Chinese were very good. They told us exactly what was happening. They gave us the genetic code for it so we could test for it. They put up these hospitals. I'm sure they would have been quite happy to be quarantined. Russia instantly quarantined China and refused to allow anybody in. Ukraine did the same. You may remember that there were some cases that had been quarantined that came back to Ukraine, and Ukraine rioted. They were pelting the coach with rocks. They had set up roadblocks. There was fires, thousands of them. Rioting, saying, keep these people out of our country. We don't want them in our country. And these people were Ukrainians that had this virus, because the Ukrainians knew how dangerous this was. And they're now one of the countries with the smallest problems, because they were so determined to keep this out. And that's how all of the West should have been. If our governments cared about our people and didn't just see us as economic units, this wouldn't have happened. If they saw us as their extended family, they wouldn't be doing this. Would you be putting your own parents at risk? Would you put your grandparents at risk? Would you put your own children at risk of catching this virus? Of course you wouldn't. And if we had a nationalist government, they wouldn't be putting us at risk because they would be seeing us as their extended family. They would, everybody would understand that we were of a shared ancestry. And it is just incredible to me that people can't see how having nationalist states is the natural way that we should be living, and that is the only way to live that is conducive to the people that actually make up that state. Now, let's get on to some of the economical side of this, because we're now being told that the economy is tanking, the stock markets have crashed, all these businesses are going to go out of business. Where are we going to get the money from? And again, this is incredible to me, absolutely incredible. They're saying, if we don't make that 1% or 2% gross domestic growth every year, then the country is in a recession and the economy is going to crash. So apparently, all we actually have to live on is just that 1 or 2% growth. But hang on a minute. Absolutely everything around us was created by us. Absolutely everything. And when you get raw materials and you do something to the raw materials, you change the raw materials into something else, you add value to those raw materials when they become something else, because we have created something. And we are the only people that can, the only thing that can actually create value is human beings. The banks don't create value. All the banks do is print promises to pay back a certain amount of money. So where is the other 98% of the gross domestic product going? How come our countries are starting out in massive debt? Our countries should be starting out with massive savings from all the things that we've created. Everything is created by us. Everything. It should be looked at as that's the value of a country. That's what has been created by that country. Instead of that, what they're effectively telling us is that 98% of that is all debt. All that is owed to somebody else. All that is owed to the banks. Now, I guess most of our listeners understand that the banks are in private hands. They're not national banks. They're not there to make a profit for the citizens of the nation, but they should be. And that's the whole point of having a sovereign, is that the sovereign can issue currency. Our sovereign gave up the right to issue currency. King William of Orange, who came to the throne after the Cromwellian Revolution, where Cromwell executed good King Charles, King William handed over the right to make currency to the Bank of England and the Jews that were running it. And they thought this was going to be a good thing, and it did bring about the British Empire. And the Jewish financial wizardry did. It was the engine that got the British Empire going. But at what cost? At what cost? It wasn't the British people that were helped out by the British Empire. Maybe they were in some ways, but we had a lot of starving Brits that were shipped out on ships over to America as slaves before they even had any black slaves. There were white people being just taken off the streets and sent over to America as indentured servants. So we didn't make any profit out of the British Empire. And from this system, from this banking system that emerged out of what they had then, because back then you still had a gold standard. And they basically said, well, what about if we loan out more money than we actually have in savings? We can get away with doing that up to about 10 times the amount that we have in the hold. Obviously, if everybody came to the bank and said, well, we want to take all our savings out, they wouldn't have been able to. But that very rarely happens. So they said, well, we'll allow the banks to lend out more than 10 times that they've actually got in savings. And what that enabled to happen was that people could speculate and they could They could borrow more money than the wealth that was actually there, and then they could use that to build businesses. And that did help to build the British Empire. It did help to build up all of this trade. But that meant that these banks were receiving back 10 times the amount of money that they actually had. And on top of that, you had usury that was put on top of everything. And eventually you get to a stage with usury where there just isn't enough. Right from the start, there just isn't enough money to pay back all the interest on the debt. If you think about it, you have a certain amount of currency that is in flotation, that's within the economy. And if you lend out a certain amount of money and then you ask for interest back on top, where's that money going to come from? It has to be created from somewhere. That interest has to be created from somewhere. Where does it get created from? It gets created by the next person that takes out a loan. And then there is enough money in circulation to pay back the interest on that first debt. But then there isn't enough money in circulation to pay back the interest on that second debt. So a third debt has to be taken out. And it's on and on and on it goes until you end up with 98% of the economy all going to service debt, when 98% of the economy should really be producing dividends for the people that created all of this wealth. All the railway lines, all the power stations, the canalways, the buildings, everything in our countries was built by us. And yet we are being told all of that doesn't belong to us. All the value of that doesn't belong to us. The only way we can just about make enough to get by and pay back the interest payments is if we just survive on 1-2% of our gross domestic product. And then something like this happens and it all crashes and there isn't enough money to go around. And people then start asking questions. And this is why I think this coronavirus thing is going to be very good for nationalism, because we have the answers to this. We've been speaking for decades about the problems of usury. We've been speaking for decades about the problems of globalism. And all those chickens are now coming home to roost all at the same time. And when people see their loved ones dying, when they see their parents and their grandparents dying, do you think they're going to be wanting to vote Labour or Tory again in the future? It falls to us to point out the reasons why this is happening and how it could have been avoided, how all of this has been brought about by anti-nationalist policies in the government, by anti-nationalist politicians. Why people don't wake up when they see the terrorism and the black on white crime and the rape gangs, I don't know, but I do think that having your parents or your grandparents needlessly dying because of this disease, because the capitalist stroke communist governments of the West wanted to keep the borders open because they thought they would make more money that way, then people are going to start questioning them. Then people are not going to be wanting to vote for them again in the future. They're going to want an alternative. And we can provide this alternative. We can be pointing this out to people. Now, there's another aspect to this, which to me, it's very ironic. It's almost like poetic justice. Last week, I spoke in one of the Daily Nationalists about the number of abortions that we have in Britain now. 1 in 4 babies are murdered in the womb. 1 in 4 babies. We're told God loves the little children. Anyone that harms a hair on their heads is going to get it. So he loves the little children, and he's had all those little children stolen from him. They've been murdered in the wombs. And why have they been murdered? For the selfishness of our people who think that a career is more important. So God has had taken from him the thing that he loves. And now we have this plague. And what is it the plague is going to take away from us? The plague is going to take away from us the thing that we love, our parents, our grandparents. So it does seem to me that there is a certain sense of irony in the people that this horrible, horrible disease is going to affect. We've also got these prophecies. There's so many prophecies talking about plagues and the angel in the book of Revelations and the bowl of the wrath of God and emptying out the plagues on the world, on the earth. And this really does seem like it is the wrath of God, and it is indiscriminate. It is indiscriminate. We need to guard ourselves from it. We need to stop ourselves from catching this. I think most nationalists are very clued up and very well aware of ways that they can avoid catching this. And we also have an edge on everybody else in the fact that we already have thriving online communities. We already have our own podcasts. We have our own media. We have our own networks. We are used to engaging in a lot of our social activities online. There are a lot of people that won't be able to handle that, that won't actually have those networks, that will be freaking out because they can't leave the house. Whereas we've already been effectively living a lot of our lives online for the last 10 or 20 years. And part of the aim of the Patriotic Alternative Conference was talking about moving the community from being online to being offline. But at the same time, we have to be very, very thankful that we do already have this great online community. And we can have the best of both worlds. We can have the offline community, and we've also got our online community. I would suggest that we should also be doing the best that we can for our white neighbours and our white elderly. And if people do set a good example by doing that, and it gets known that people are nationalists or people find out about your politics, then they're going to be far more likely to support you and not be against you. Because this is one of the ways that we can show that we are good people. Nationalists are the best people. We make the best neighbours. We look after our own. And this is one of those times when we get to demonstrate that, when we get to show people how much our extended family means to us. And just moving back to thinking about the effects on the economy again, and with the banking system and the way that I explained it, the way we used to avoid this happening before, because we did always loan out money. We always had money that was loaned out, and we had a system that if you loaned out money and it was for a business venture, then you would share the profits with the person you loaned the money out to, and you would also share the losses. That's the difference to how we have it now. When a bank loans you the money and your business venture fails, the bank still expects to get that money back. Now, our system that we used to have, if you borrowed money from a bank, the bank would expect to take a third of the profits or whatever, but they would also take a third of the losses. And if it all failed, then that was it. The bank had lost the money. But one way that it was prevented from ending up in a situation where you're just living on 2% of what the whole country produces, and you're still paying back debts from 100 years ago, every 7 years, all debts would be absolved. There would be a jubilee year. And I believe Alfred the Great spoke about this. So it was going on in Saxon England. They would have this jubilee year. It's a Christian tradition. And every 7 years, everything would be zeroed. Everything would go back. If you had bought land, that land would go back to the person who originally had that land. That land was family land. The slaves would be freed. Everything would be zeroed. And that would prevent these huge debts accruing, where one person can just effectively buy up everything. That would prevent that from happening. And the king would be the one that would enforce all of this. And the king would be the one that would issue the money. What is the point of being a sovereign if you can't issue currency? How can we just be living on such a tiny fraction of our gross domestic product when we are the ones that give value to that? We're the ones that give value to the currency in the first place. It's illegal for banks to loan out their savings. The way money is created is when a so-called borrower goes to the bank and promises to pay back a certain amount of money by a certain time. And what he's actually promising to do is to create that money from somewhere. And the bank just monetizes that promise. They monetize that IOU. If you look at banknotes, it says, I promise to pay the bearer. So what they have done is, all they have done is published your promise to pay them a certain amount of money by a certain time. So what they do is they create that amount of money there and then, and it goes into circulation. And then you have to work to pay that back to the bank, the money that you actually created with your promise. It was your promise that gave it that value. It was you keeping your word that actually gave it that value. And then you have to pay back interest on the top. And when it goes back to the bank keeps it. So you created all that money. You created every bit of that through your work. You created a certain amount of value, whether it was through work that you did or whatever you created, whatever that loan was for. Let's say the loan was for a house and you used that money to build a house. You created the value for that, and then you sold that house on, and the bank got the money. The bank got all the money for that. We should be getting a dividend from everything that we create. Not these private corporations. The very fact that private corporations are getting all the dividends, the banks are getting all the value from this, it just shows you what traitors our governments are, what traitors our leaders are, to have allowed a system like this to take hold. And this coronavirus, this could very well be the thing that destroys that system. They may very well have to zero everything and start again. How can they collect on debts when all the businesses are failing and going into liquidation? They're going to have to do something to keep it all going, and they might, and that something may very well end up being having to zero everything. And once again, our traditions, our Christian traditions, are proved to be the way that we should be living. The only way to keep in accordance with natural law and to prosper and thrive as white people. Anyway, thank you very much for listening. Stay safe and healthy. Tune in again tomorrow for more of the Daily Nationalist. God bless and hail victory.
You're listening to Radio Albion, talk radio for the nationalist community.